IVM.
In the year 2050, the number of people on the planet will be 10 billion. 1/6 of those people will be in India. If we want to feed all of us, we need to reimagine the way we make our food. All across the global food system, there's a clear understanding that change needs to take place in the way we manage land and water, reduce waste, and ensure that the food system isn't contributing to climate change in the form of greenhouse gases. At the Good Food Institute, the major question which drives our work is, how do we feed, how do we nourish those 10 billion people by 2050 through systems which don't adversely affect the planet, its scarce natural resources, and public health? We've identified the problems and focused our work to one particular sector, one particular area receiving a great deal of attention because of its implications for the future of the planet. Protein. More specifically, protein and foods sourced from animals like meat, eggs, and dairy.
If we want to achieve our goals of feeding all those people, we're not going to do it by getting our protein from meat. And you've seen all the headlines and all the reports. UN scientists have pointed out that every single environmental problem, big or small, local or global, is negatively impacted by the way we grow animals for food. It contributes more to climate change than all emissions from all the planes, trucks, and cars in the world. Basically, all forms of transportation combined. It also guzzles way more water, uses way more energy, and of course, occupies far too much land. The Earth is a little less than 1/3 land. And fully half of this land is already used for farming. The rest is our dwindling forests and shrublands. Now, out of that land used for agriculture, over 2/3 is used for rearing livestock. And all that land, all those resources devoted to animals, to meat, eggs, and dairy, it only gives us 1/3 of the world's protein supply.
So why is this happening? Why are we using all these resources to get such meager returns? It has to do with a basic biological equation. We grow crops like soy and grains like wheat to feed animals, and then we eat just a small portion of those animals. So when it comes to chicken, for instance, for every 9 calories of feed, we get 1 calorie of protein back in the form of flesh. And chickens are the most efficient animal raised for meat. Despite decades of breeding and optimization, we're bumping up against the hard biological limits of what's possible. Animals are just a really bad protein production platform. And we're not going to solve the problem by looking to the oceans either. Overfishing and polluting is pushing entire species like cod and bluefin tuna to the brink of extinction. Simply put, it's just better for us to be eating chickpeas instead of chicken and cod.
But every study shows us that despite evidence that eating a plant-based diet is crucial to meeting our environmental goals and to avert disastrous climate crises, consumers just don't want to give up meat. As we speak, the Amazon rainforest has been on fire for nearly 3 weeks and is being actively cleared away to make land available for animals to graze on. But we can't just guilt people into switching. Every study on food consumption so far indicates that consumers don't want to sacrifice their meat. They want a simple switch, one that is based on taste, price, and convenience. And rightly so. The likely answer to this problem? Give people meat, seafood, and all sorts of other foods they love, just made in a better way. Researchers and companies all over the world are pioneering techniques of making delicious, nutritious meat, eggs, and dairy without the same effect on the planet. And the heroes within this path-breaking innovation are two separate categories called plant-based meat and cell-based meat. Plant-based meat is quite simply meat made from plants, while cell-based meat is meat grown through cellular agriculture in what look like meat breweries with no animal slaughter required.
Companies in this new exciting sector like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods are making plant-based meat globally, while those like Memphis Meats and Mosa Meat pioneer cell-based meat. Investors like Bill Gates, Richard Branson, and Google Ventures are sitting up, taking notice, and putting money into these companies. And if you've been paying attention, you know that they have been making waves on the stock market, in restaurants, in massive food chains. But there's a long way to go yet. If we're truly going to effect a transformation in global protein supply, what's happened thus far is merely an appetizer. At the Good Food Institute, we're working with governments, investors, scientists and entrepreneurs, pretty much anyone who can help us serve up the future of protein. I'm Varun Deshpande, the Managing Director of the Good Food Institute India.
And I'm Ramya Ramurthy, the Communications Specialist at the Good Food Institute India. And you're listening to Feeding 10 Billion. Today, we are joined by our colleagues Ruveen Arsaria, Aishwarya Ghosh and Siddharth Bhide. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Hi, I'm excited.
I'm excited too, to be here.
Okay, so let's start off by asking each of you to tell us a bit about yourselves. What do you do and why did you decide to join the Good Food Institute? Ruveen, why don't you start?
Yeah, so I essentially work as the Corporate Engagement Specialist at the Good Food Institute. That name sounds like a lot of like titles mushed in together, but essentially it is reaching out to big food businesses and startups in the country. Anything that is commercially, having the capability of putting products out there and helping them increase the availability, the quantity and the quality of plant-based food in India. So yeah, that's what I do in a nutshell. And how I landed up here is actually a sort of topsy-turvy journey. Let me just like clarify straight off the bat that I don't have like a specific food background or I wasn't into the industry, so to speak, before this. I actually didn't know what I wanted to do for a really long time. And that's what led me to journalism because I was curious if nothing else. And along the way, I picked up a couple of things like communication, partnership building and stuff like that. And that led me to work at Fishberry, which is a crowdfunding platform. And I think what my lens on things always was to look at something that's offering a tangible solution to a real problem that exists. And I think that's also what led me here because, you know, when you see the facts that one single piece of steak, like a red meat steak, uses up 3,515 liters of water, which is an average person's consumption for 5 years. And that along with this, you have solutions in the West, like Beyond and Impossible that Varun was just mentioning, which can actually deliver the same amount of protein and the taste, but just made in better ways. It just seems foolish, right, for us to be consuming meat the way we do then today. And I wanted to be a part of the solution and try and affect things in any way I can within the commercial sector here. And yeah, that's why I'm here.
So unlike Dhruvi, Siddharth, you've actually worked in the food industry. Can you tell us a bit about your background and why you joined us?
Yeah, so I work as the Science and Technology Specialist with the Good Food Institute India, and I'm a food scientist by training. I have undergrad and graduate degrees in food science. I did my undergrad at Usmani University in Hyderabad and then master's at Rutgers University in New Jersey. A couple of stints, like I did an internship with Nestle and then a couple of internships with General Mills. And my last stint was with this company called Just, based out of San Francisco, where we made plant-based eggs, plant-based mayonnaise, plant-based cookie dough. So basically trying to replicate what eggs do as a whole, and also in terms of their functionality as an emulsifier or in terms of structure building. So throughout my career, which has been pretty small till now, but throughout this, I've been really interested in the science part of it, and that's why it led me to various steps, like technical side of things. And I really believe that plant-based foods and cell-based foods are the way to go to ensure sustainability. And companies like Just, Beyond Meat, or Impossible have proven that it is possible to make products which are very similar to animal products. And that really led me, and you know, when I was looking at what I want to do next in my career, it led me to Good Food Institute India, because I see India as a very high impact country, given the growing population and growing meat consumption in this country. And if we can make an impact here, we would also be making an impact in the whole world. So that's why I'm here.
Great. Joe, you are joining us as a development person. Tell us a bit about what you do and where you're coming from.
Thanks for having me here, Ramya. So I have a background, I have training as an economist, and I did my stint in investment banking, post which I really wanted to get into social development. And my hypothesis was, I think the biggest change that I think with the center of gravity shifting to India, I wanted to do work here. I joined this organization called TechnoServe, and I worked there as leading their business development arm, essentially designing large programs around agricultural transformation and agri-market facilitation. Post that, I was on a sabbatical and I was holidaying in Bhutan when I came upon the GFI job posting. And I think the message that it completely resonated with me, and it just felt like a powerful idea whose time has come. And yeah, after that, I had 3 meetings and I joined here. So part of my work in GFI involves building mission-driven partnerships with our allies and just generally kind of raising awareness of our work in India.
So Joe, we talk a lot about why it's very important for the major philanthropic donors all over the world. So whether it's Indian organizations like the Azim Premji Philanthropic Initiatives or global giga foundations like Rockefeller Institute to be involved in sectors like this and bring in catalytic funding. Why is that? Why is it so important for them to be involved?
So just one tiny tidbit of history, right? Like, so the Green Revolution in India, that was all kind of originated from seminal funding from Rockefeller Foundation and Ford Foundation. So the power of philanthropy is immense. It's, I think, properly channeled, it can lead to huge catalytic impact over the decades. And I think that's the promise, right? Those are the philanthropists we want to reach out to. That's what we want to harness when we're thinking of our vision for India.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly right. I mean, I think one of the things that needs to happen in sectors like this, but more broadly across the food system, areas which are more nascent, which require technology transformation, and this is quite urgent, they require funding to come in from visionary investors like government and like giga foundations. If you look at any technology underpinned transformation that's happened throughout history, just like you said with the Green Revolution, which was technology blended with new practices from farmers, we're going to need people who can see its potential early on and who can see the imperative to create transformation in these systems. And so I'm very glad that we're working with government in places like India. If you look at some of the problems that are affected by the food system today, particularly the animal agriculture ecosystem, as we speak currently, one third of the pig population in China is being decimated due to what's known as African swine fever. This is happening because of various reasons. Because of the nature of animal production, these animals are being produced or grown in close containment with each other. They're being fed antibiotics because that's an economic imperative for the companies in order to make sure that their product gets out into the market. But it tends to breed these superbugs. And that's something we have to have a huge mind towards, is helping these companies see the potential of these new production systems as well.
Okay, taking off from that, we mentioned big companies. Dhruvi, you deal with corporate engagement with GFI India. Why is it so important that big food companies like Nestle, DuPont or Unilever get into this new protein sector? Globally, we know that some of them like Nestle and Unilever have launched products or have, you know, invested in this space. But how are we going to convince them to do it in India? And why is it imperative that they do so?
Yeah, so I think I'll just take the question in a couple of parts. Why they should get involved is because as a business, this is good business for them. I mean, if you just look at the stats, 70% of Indians do purchase packaged food. Having said that, upwards of 65% of them are protein deficient. And, you know, it just makes sense to be able to plug that gap as a food company. So that's number one. Number two, why not do it in a way that doesn't, you know, negatively affect the environment or human health? And if you just look at the trends that are shaping up too, it's all pointing towards that. I mean, the number of products that have launched in the last few years with high protein claims have doubled. So it's clear that the commercial sector has to align with consumer sentiment when it comes to this entire field. Having said that, you know, in India, I think the way we do talk to these companies and the lens that they have to take is that it's going to be a different story. It's probably not going to be burgers. We don't need that many of them. If we ask every single person sitting in this recording room today what the national dish of our country is, I think we'll get different answers, which means that there's an opportunity here for companies to come up with diverse products to satisfy that need. So, you know, from biryani to keema to jackfruit curries in the south, I mean, the opportunities are vast. And I think it's time that they start investigating where this can go over here. So, yeah, that's what we try and tell them, that look at the story a little differently. Look at the fact that our population, you know, the income is rising, the spending power is rising, the home householding patterns are changing. We're cooking at home a little lesser than we used to. We're living away from parents more. And having said that, there's also this other dilemma to tackle, right? Which is that we have a lot of contrasting religious and political factors at play, along with the fact that we're going to have the youngest population in the world pretty soon. And we're eating and wanting to eat like our global counterparts do. So then this entire sector of plant-based and clean meat becomes like the perfect middle ground solution to satisfy all these different vectors, which are sometimes contrasting, as they always are in a country like India. So yeah, that's what we're trying to tell them, that come in when the time is right. and look at it differently.
Siddharth, you joined us from Just, where you worked on this visionary egg product. And it's an egg product that's made from mung beans, but it behaves exactly like eggs, right? So I've been looking at the numbers and Just sold their 10 millionth egg equivalent recently. Showcasing the impact of their work, they said the number of eggs they sold were made with 98% less water, emitted 93% less carbon dioxide, and used 86% less land. But the point is, it's orders of magnitude better than conventional egg production. So could you tell me what the challenges are for the Indian scientific ecosystem to develop products like this? Because this is truly game-changing.
Yeah, definitely. So to begin, you know, I would say that all the products, I mean, even Just Egg or something like the Beyond Burger or Impossible Burger, these are technical products. You need expertise in a lot of different fields to actually make a technical product like this. So you need people right from biochemists who would actually study, fractionate the plant and then study the different fractions of proteins, starches, etc., which would contribute to the functionality. And then you need like a food science team, a food engineering team to actually make the formulations, which will give you the right texture, the right flavor, similar to an egg, similar to the meat products. And then you also need an entire manufacturing team, which could comprise of like engineers and operations team who know how to scale these products up the correct way. So right now in India, we do have scientific talents in all these fields. But what we need to work on is to create a database wherein if an entrepreneur or if any corporation wants to make a product like this, they should have access to the right resources. And that is something I think, you know, we at GFI are also working on, to like identifying like which researchers, right from academic researchers at different universities, like what parts of science are they working on. Like we might have a professor at a certain university who's studying the functional properties of a certain plant protein, like say for example gelation, and that could be very useful in making a product like Just Egg, where, you know, the main property which we have exploited in an egg is that of a gelation. So even with mung bean, what Just had done, they found out that it gelled really well just like an egg, and that was the main property what we exploited over there. So, you know, identifying scientific researchers, they're identifying which protein suppliers, like something like the Rockets and the DuPonts, etc., can actually provide these ingredients in large quantities and can work with the researchers and entrepreneurs to develop functional products. And then finding out the right laboratories or the food technical consultants who can use years of experience in developing food products to kind of make this novel new product, to like food manufacturers who could scale it up the right way.
How much work did it take to do this at Just?
So I think the work is still going on. The goal is always to make the product much better and for it to make it as close as possible to an egg in terms of all functionalities that eggs exhibit. And in terms of timeline, you know, I think Just started in 2013 and we launched our product in 2017. So it was about 4 years. But then again, the development was a two-stream process. I mean, we were developing the protein isolate, and then we were also developing a product. So it's quite a technical process. And again, as I was mentioning earlier, it involved working together of a lot of different competencies.
Joe, this is addressed at you, but all of you can jump in. You know, a lot of people, when we talk about what we do, they ask us, why India? And that's actually a curious question, because India is a very complex and complicated country, right? We are a majority meat-eating country. And the myth is that we're vegetarian, but we're not. Despite being a majority meat-eating country, we only eat about less than 5 kilos of meat per person per year. And even within that, the consumer category of, say, a flexitarian, right? We don't really know how many of us are flexitarians as meat eaters. So there's a lot of data darkness in terms of who we really are in terms of our approach to eating meat. And that's also contrasted with the meat industry in India, which is fairly unorganized and it's not as industrial as our counterparts in the West. So when it comes to pitching the India case for doing what we do, how do you convince people that it's urgent to sort of get involved right now?
Right. And I think some of that data darkness kind of leads to our hypotheses, right? So firstly, we look at like per capita metrics, right? 4 to 4.5 kilos. What we forget, it's like India has a population of 1.3 billion. When you multiply that, that's a sizable problem. If you kind of compound it 10% over 5 years, that's a massive problem. And I think a lot of these, like the challenges that we face across the world regarding industrial animal agriculture, many of those battles will be kind of fought and won or lost in India simply because of the numbers. The other thing I would like to kind of mention here is we always look at the base number. We look at 4 to 4.5 kilos. It's so low. We don't look at the journey, how we got it. And I'm pretty sure the journey is exponential. even from a very low base, it's been exponential and it will be exponential going forward. Third thing is, I think we look at meat, but we have to understand that affordability is a big factor, right? So what's a meat substitute? It's eggs. We make an egg curry to substitute meat curries. Egg production and consumption has been like shooting. So we've probably, over the last 5 years or so, we've doubled egg consumption. And I think our national action plan calls for probably 3 times the egg target. So probably 180 eggs, probably by 2030. And this brings us to the fourth number, which is 2030. A large proportion of the problems or the challenges we are trying to solve peak by 2030. So action is urgent. We need to take immediate action. There's a bunch of kind of allied areas which peak even before 2030, probably in the early 2020s for India. And I think that's the urgency we need to convey every time we talk to, I think, anyone who wants to know more about the work we are doing.
Also, to add to Joe's point, like he correctly said, it's, I think, more of an income issue, because if you see the last surveys that they did on the Indian population and its diets, the SRS survey in 2014 said that 71% of Indians are non-vegetarians. So the fact that India is a vegetarian country is most certainly a myth if 70% of us are non-vegetarian in that survey. Maybe we're eating meat on different days of the week, you know, for religious reasons, or we're eating less of it because we can't afford it. But that doesn't mean it's going to stay like that as people and their preferences change. And also what I personally believe is that we cannot afford the mistakes of the West. So we definitely have to leapfrog those mistakes, because in our case, with our population, those will sort of be unforgivable.
On that note, we'll slip into a short break, but come back for more conversation on Feeding 10 Billion.
Welcome back to Feeding 10 Billion. We've been chatting about how, in order to effect a transformation in the global food system, you need to have a scientific talent pool, you need to have manufacturing capability, you need to have capital. In India, we have something that's a bit of a secret weapon, though. And that is our tremendous agricultural biodiversity, which gives us a toolkit with which to work to create an explosion of new kinds of products. Whether it's governments, universities, or businesses, pretty much everyone is looking to invest in millets or pulses like chickpeas and create a whole new slew of products from them, which include products that pertain to the replacement of meat, eggs, and dairy. So I wanted to put a question to you guys. In the course of your work, what have you seen are the major opportunities and the barriers to using this tremendous agricultural biodiversity?
I think one of the secret weapons, like you said, is definitely millets. India is the largest producer of millets in the entire world. I mean, these crops are climate hardy inherently. Let's say for 1 kilo of millets, they use 300 liters of water as opposed to the 5,000 liters for growing 1 kilo of rice. So yes, the climate hardiness is obvious. What's even more interesting with indigenous crops like millets is that they are super healthy, and that's something that the population currently needs. So in India, just to set a little bit more of context here, we're facing like a double burden of nutrition, where on the upper end of the pyramid, we have problems like diabetes and obesity. And on the lower end, I mean, the numbers are really sad, where, you know, you can just safely say that 1 in 10 children in India are properly nourished. So millets here present a wonderful opportunity, because not only are they gluten-free and low GI, thus great for diabetes, but they also come with this entire treasure house of micronutrients, from iron, zinc and calcium to B12. And yeah, they're right in our backyard, so we must be using them. And growing and, you know, figuring out a value chain for them here is doubly important, because while they can be used for local consumption, they can also be used as a supply ingredient for the global supply chain for the entire plant-based meat industry.
And adding on to that, you know, what Dhruvi just said, you know, if you look at meat, if you look at eggs or dairy, fundamentally, you know, it's a combination of proteins, fats, carbohydrates aligned together in a certain way to give a certain type of texture and flavor, what we call this taste a certain way. And with our great agricultural ecodiversity in India of different crops available, we can actually utilize them, take these crops, fractionate them into their individual proteins, individual carbohydrates, starches, fats, and actually use food processing technologies to again realign all these ingredients together to replicate the texture and flavor of these different animal products. And again, like some crops like chickpeas or mung bean could be really high in protein and could contribute to protein aspect. Some crops like millets, which are really high in calcium, some of them, you know, could contribute to the micronutrient aspect. So India has a fabulous set of crops to work with to really achieve what we want to achieve here.
So one more thing I would just like to add to what Siddharth mentioned. There are a couple of barriers that we can see which is holding up the adoption of millets at large scale. Foremost is the lack of farmer economics and the ability to kind of plug into robust value chains. Number two would be, I think, the relative lack of food science research in millets compared to wheat, rice, or soy, right? The fact that still makes these grains novel, exotic, referred to as indigenous. I think that's what needs to change over the longer term. But I think there are steps being taken in the right direction.
Having worked with this sector or in this sector for the past couple of months, for Siddharth and Varun, it's longer, obviously, it's in years. If you could distill all the learning you've had over the past few, in your time in this sector, into a couple of points, what would you want our listeners to go away with?
I think the one, you know, big takeaway for me has been from someone who is outside of the sector and outside of the industry and probably just reading what's, you know, on mainstream media and things like that. It was a really pessimistic, you know, picture of these horrible stats of global warming and of antibiotic resistance and just like a doomsday picture. And while actually working on things, I've been pretty encouraged because I do see change happening. It's happening in pockets. It's happening, you know, probably at a pace which definitely needs to be increased, but it's definitely happening. And that's what's been super encouraging to me, from the fact that, you know, corporations are thinking about fortifying food, to the fact that climate change and sustainability is up as a key theme on panels that I go to. And, you know, the fact that every young entrepreneur today is considering food and agri-tech and thinking about it, not just in a way to like make profit, but thinking about it from a sustainability point of view, have all been super encouraging. So yeah, my viewpoint has just changed in the sense that it's become a lot more optimistic and I do see change on ground, but a lot more needs to be done.
Siddharth?
Yeah, so having worked in the technology and science aspect of it for a long time now, I believe that change is possible and we have already seen that happening throughout the world, be it the Just Egg, be it the Impossible Burger. You know, these are phenomenal products. I mean, no one would have believed it if anyone would have mentioned this concept 10 years back and they would be like, wait, what does that even mean? How can you make it? But these companies have shown that it is possible. And I think with any technology, like in the food science and the food processing world, even retorting, homogenization, etc., all these high pressure processing, all these technologies, when they first started, people didn't really believe in it. But then science and technology progressed with time, and then now they are like economically viable too. So something similar is happening in the plant based and cell based research too. And I'm pretty optimistic that within a few years' time, you know, these products are going to be dominating the market.
Yeah, and I think just drawing on the same thread, I've seen a lot of acceptance amongst the donors or stakeholders I meet, and that's been very encouraging. I came in here with, of course, no background in food, but something, again, like as Siddharth mentioned, I think 10 years ago, we wouldn't believe this could be possible, right? So pretty much like sci-fi adjacent. And I come in here and talk to people at all levels, at different organizations, and I can see that there's acceptance. I think there's people excited by the potential and what the promise of, say, probably a truly unique Indian solution to this. Yeah, so that's encouraging.
During the course of our work, we've obviously worked with very technology-forward solutions that account for consumers and what they actually want to eat in various ways. I wanted to ask you all a question about what do you think in the course of your work has been neglected, even by our very, very forward-thinking sector? What do you think has been neglected? Where are the biggest opportunities for growth even within our sector?
I think for me, the one part that really needs to catch up to speed is the talent pool. So while I feel a lot of work has been done in, you know, matchmaking, let's say entrepreneurs with investors or consumer research, you know, where we're trying to investigate local preferences and thus what positioning should eventually look like, there is a big gap when it comes to getting actual talent ready for the sector. And that may involve, you know, specialized courses and universities and things like that, which we are looking at doing in the West. But in India, I think that's something that I'm looking forward, you know, for our team to take up probably very soon.
So I think just pitching a slightly longer term view, I think at this point, of course, we're focused on kind of first or the problems, research, sci-tech. I think once the product matures, I think we're at this point, we need to look at more market-shaping activities in the future. And I think probably we'll shift to more non-glamorous aspects of product development, right? Shelf stability, like can this be stored at a Kirana store? Stuff like that. It's not very glamorous, but that's what we'll think about in 5 to 10 years.
That sounds pretty glamorous and cool to me. I don't know about you, but that sounds really good to me. Yeah. Siddharth?
I think my answer would be a combination, again, in line with what Dhruvi and Joe said. I think what is lacking right now is really scientists and researchers to really think above and beyond. I mean, okay, we have Beyond Burger right now. We have Impossible Burger right now. But what's next? I mean, there could be a whole new product out there, which is there's no animal analogous product for that product. So I think that's how we need to think. I mean, and that's how innovations do happen. So I think that's something we need to catch up and work on.
And just to chime in, I mean, we've focused primarily on plant-based and cell-based meat, eggs and dairy, but that also includes a vital component of planet Earth, which is the sea and the seafood it contains. And we know that we're overfishing and we're running out of food from the sea, and there's plastic in our fish as well. So that's going to be one big part of the solution as well, not just have plant-based burgers or cell-based meat made from animals, but also include, you know, seafood in this vast offering that we're going to build up over the years. Which leads us to our podcast theme, which is feeding 10 billion, and we'll number 10 billion in the year 2050. So if you could put your 2050 lens on and tell us, what do you think we'll be eating in that year? Or what do you think a day in your life will be like that year?
So I'll go first. And I think I would love to have a 3D printer in my house, which prints out food as I want. That would be the perfect kind of future I would like to live in.
I think I'm a nostalgic person in general. So in 2050, I'd just like to think back to 2020 and 2019 and think about the time where how landlines are obsolete today. In 2050, eating meat the way we do today would be obsolete. And it would be like, oh, remember back when we used to actually slaughter animals?
Yeah, I think we would again. I mean, I would say that even if we are still eating meat, eggs and dairy, but this time it would be from plant-based and cell-based sources where we need not be guilty about what we are doing. And we know that the meat we are eating or the eggs we are eating are coming from the right sources and from the right type of the way that it should be coming from.
So when we came up with the idea of the podcast, my ideal listener was actually a friend or someone I know who knows I work in this sector, and I'm just trying to address their common complaints or questions or, you know, just gaps in what they know about the food system right now. What would you say are some of the biggest myths that you'd like to dispel about the sector? You know, when I talk about this to my friends, they ask me, is it just for like South Bombay folks or South Delhi folks? Is it only for vegans? Is it a vegan-only sort of trend? How do you deal with the questions that come your way, and what are the questions that come your way?
So I think one question which always comes my way, like whenever I talk about plant-based meat, like my friends are like, oh, is it like soy chops? We already have soy chops out in the market. And I'm like, okay, that's not what, I mean, that's one of the products that's in the way of what we want to do. Like, but then that is not our end goal. And then a lot of times I actually end up showing them Beyond Meat's website and Impossible's website or even some YouTube videos. And then they are pretty amazed by what they see. And they're like, wait, that's not beef, or, you know, wait, that's not chicken with some other companies. And then I'm like, no, that's entirely made up of plants, or it's made from cell-based meat. And then they are like, what is cell-based meat? And then I'm like, it's just like cultivating cells, not, you know, they are making meat inside a lab. And they are like, wait, so like in test tubes? And then I'm like, yeah, exactly, in petri dishes and test tubes. And they're like, wait, that's possible? So there are a lot of myths, and it's really interesting to like educate them on what's happening. And that's what we want to do. I mean, we want to change the way the consumer thinks about all of this. I think that's the biggest win.
Yeah, I think limiting it to vegans or like just the vegan movement would be limiting the entire sector, because the entire idea is to give consumers who love meat something that they love but just made differently, right? Whether it's cell-based or plant-based, which is the method of production rather than the actual end product changing. And that's why if you see like the main consumers in the West of like these huge companies like Beyond and Impossible are actually meat eaters. They're not vegans, because I mean, vegans in all probability anyway would, you know, stick to eating vegetables and not go towards the meat side. And that's why the investors for the sector also are super diverse, right? From like Bill Gates to Jay-Z and Snoop Dogg. I mean, it's crazy the kind of support this entire sector has got.
Yeah, and crucially also the biggest meat companies in the world, right? So Tyson Foods, Cargill, we talked about them earlier.
Yeah.
And I think I face a similar problem with my friends, where I think it's referencing, right? You reference based on your experiences. So meat eaters say, oh, well, it's a vegan meat. Vegans do not like meat, right? And it's a whole confusion, and it's difficult for me to kind of explain it or like just use their references to kind of explain it, what it is.
I think it's like explaining AirPods back when like we were listening to like vinyl CDs and stuff, right? It's difficult to imagine a technology product that's so much more advanced than what we're seeing every day on our plates.
Absolutely. And I think this technology shift hasn't happened, right? Like in probably thousands of years, we are now kind of shifting from animal protein technology essentially as a platform and making this jump. And to think of it, it's mind-boggling that it's taken so long.
That's the piece that's most exciting to me personally. So we're not really, I mean, I get the vegan, non-vegan, like, you know, KFC is now serving Beyond Meat. And then people are asking on Twitter, like, is this for vegans? Why would vegans go to KFC? No, it's not for vegans. That debate is less interesting to me than this idea, which is that we, the industry, the Good Food Institute, the companies within it, we are changing the way the entire food industry sources food. So you go to a gas station now in the United States, and whereas you would have only seen like beef jerky one generation ago or 5 years ago, you're going to see a plant protein bar right there next to it or instead of it. So it's not just plant-based meats or cell-based meat that are taking off. It's also the way that food companies are sourcing and distributing products. And it's a huge shift that reaches all the way out to the consumer, and that's being participated in by the most diverse companies you would have never thought of.
So there you have it. The global food system is in need of transformation, and we need participation from the biggest food and technology companies, from governments, from foundations, from scientists and entrepreneurs, pretty much everyone who can help make this transformation. The challenges we face today are myriad and are rapidly coming to a head. Sooner or later, we're going to have to reckon with climate change, ocean dead zones, antimicrobial resistance, and of course, malnutrition. Companies like Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, Memphis Meats and Just are proving that we can tackle them through food innovation. And the markets are responding extremely positively. 2019 may just be remembered as the year that new protein sector took off.
But is it going to be enough? Our challenge in places like India is to align investment and talent with the future of food and make sure that we do it quickly. It's a gargantuan task and a long journey, but we're doing everything we can to make sure we pull it off. If we do, the possibilities are endless. We're talking about building a post-scarcity vision for meat, for smart protein, a future where human and planetary health are in sync. On Feeding 10 Billion, you're going to get the inside view on this journey as we talk to collaborators including investors, technologists, chefs, and entrepreneurs. If you like this podcast, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can listen to us on the IVM Podcast app or ivmpodcasts.com. You can also follow us on our social media. We are at IVM Podcasts on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to reach out to me, I am VarunD7 on Twitter and VaronFive, Varun5 on Instagram. You can come ask me why.
And if you want to reach out to me, I am Cryptic Caprice on Twitter and Dithering Funambulist on Instagram. Please don't ask me why.
We look forward to having you with us every week. And of course, if you'd like to be a part of accelerating the future, just get in touch. I'm Varun Deshpande, Managing Director for India at the Good Food Institute.
And I'm Ramya Ramamurthy, the Communications Specialist at the Good Food Institute India. And you've been part of Feeding 10 Billion.